From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden, our guest, General David Petraeus, retired U.S. Army General and former director of the CIA. He is currently partner at KKR, a leading global investment firm where he chairs the firm's Global Institute. According to KKR's website, General Petraeus served over 37 years in the U.S. military, culminating his career with six consecutive commands, five of which were in combat, including command of the surge in Iraq, command of U.S. Central Command, and command of coalition forces in Afghanistan. Following retirement from the military, General Petraeus served as director of the CIA during a period of significant achievements in the global war on terror. General Petraeus graduated with distinction from the U.S. Military Academy. He also earned a PhD from Princeton University's School of Public and International Affairs. He is known as a legend in Washington for having the rare combination of qualities of both a warrior and scholar. Jeff Selden and I will talk with the general about the challenges in Afghanistan as the Biden administration decides how to execute or modify the U.S.-Taliban peace agreement negotiated under the Trump administration. We will also ask him to assess other key national security and counterterrorism concerns, and as the number and magnitude of domestic terrorism incidents, especially those from white supremacists and anti-government militias, rise in the United States, we will ask General Petraeus for his reflections on that as well. And General Petraeus joins us via Microsoft Teams. General, welcome to the program.
Great to be back, Carol. Thank you.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeff Selden. So, General Petraeus, I wonder if you could briefly reflect on the Trump years that we just experienced. How much damage do you think might have been done to U.S. national security, including Mr. Trump's unfortunate trashing of allies and his embrace of non-democratic rulers? This is a corollary. Although it's early days, how would you evaluate Biden's approach thus far?
Well, first of all, I should point out that I am truly non-political in the United States, not just bipartisan. I stopped registering to vote when I became a two-star general, and I haven't returned to doing that. And I would have a little bit more nuanced view of the foreign policy of the previous administration. There were a number of significant achievements during that time. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the Abraham Accords, negotiating away the challenges of the dispute between Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar, strengthening of the relationship with India, maintaining the strong relationship with Japan, and even resetting the conversation on China. I think many in Washington, if not most, would say that all of these were achievements during the previous administration. But as you noted, there clearly was, beyond the normal degree of criticism of allies who were not, for example, in the case of NATO, spending the agreed 2% of GDP on defense. And the tone was certainly more harsh in that regard. And that was true of a number of the other relationships around the world as well. Beyond that, I think perhaps even more significant was just the sense of, again, America first, meaning America going it alone, rather than constantly trying to secure whole of governments with an S on the end, approaches to the various challenges around the world, a proposition that I have always put forward as being the ideal way to go. So in that regard, certainly the Biden administration's explicit embrace of alliances, of partnerships, its commitment to reinvigorate them is very welcome around the world by those countries in particular that were on the receiving end from the previous administration of some of the more stinging comments. And I think it is very appropriate that as the United States pursues foreign policy at home by shoring up its domestic foundations for national power, combating the pandemic, spurring the economic recovery, addressing infrastructure needs, and bringing the country together to the extent that that is possible, all of that being critically important to the approach to the world, I think off to quite an impressive start. noting, of course, that you already have cases where campaign rhetoric is colliding with reality. And as we'll discuss, of course, the situation in Afghanistan is one such case. But that is always the situation for any new administration, noting that we're still very much at the general stages of policy formulation and declaration. It's when it gets into the details that the decisions become really most difficult. Noting, though, that some have already been established in certain respects, the approach toward China, the approach toward allies, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, returning to the World Health Organization, and above all, trying to seek multilateral international solutions as much as is possible, particularly given how important that is in time of a pandemic when no one of us is safe unless all of us are safe.
General, I want to thank you very much for your very nuanced analysis of both the Trump administration and now the challenges facing Biden administration. And now I'd like to turn to my colleague, Jeff Selden. Jeff, take it away.
General, you mentioned Afghanistan earlier, and it's become one of the most urgent, pressing challenges for the Biden administration. Last year, the U.S. and the Taliban signed a deal that calls for a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces by May 1st. And the latest from the White House has been that the president is still considering the terms of that deal. It's still reviewing the deal. Time's running out, though. May 1st is quickly approaching. So two questions based on your experience. Can the U.S. safely meet a May 1st deadline and pull some 2,500, 3,500 troops out of Afghanistan? And in your opinion, should it meet that deadline?
First of all, physically, it's probably not possible. And second, I very much question the wisdom of doing it as well. And here up front, let me just note that no one wants to see endless wars end more than those who have actually fought in them and have been privileged to lead America's sons and daughters and coalition forces in these conflicts and know what the sacrifices those conflicts have entailed. That said, I very strongly underscore the word that candidate Biden always attached to his statements about ending endless wars, in particular ending the war in Afghanistan. He would then add responsibly. That's crucial because we should be very careful to recognize that we don't end an endless war by ending U.S. involvement in it. We end U.S. involvement. That's it. And we shouldn't be so U.S.-centric as to think that just by withdrawing our forces that the war ends. In fact, in many cases, it gets worse. And Afghanistan would undoubtedly be one of those cases. If the U.S. was to withdraw, you would see enormous challenges to Afghan security forces, which in many cases are enabled critically by the very small element of U.S. advisors, but the very considerable capabilities that we have overhead in the form of drones and close air support, and also in support through fusion of intelligence, as well as training and equipping and sustaining and a variety of other elements, again, of that assistance. If those forces crumble, you could see an exodus from Kabul very, very quickly. In fact, I think that the sheer announcement of a withdrawal would lead to the withdrawal of most of the other coalition forces, which actually outnumber U.S. forces by a fair amount right now. Beyond that, you'd see international organizations, which do a great deal for the Afghan people. Keep in mind that one of the huge differences that I used to point out between Afghanistan and Iraq is that Afghanistan can barely generate $2 billion of revenue in a good year, whereas Iraq could generate $100 billion just in oil revenue, at least once we patched up the pipelines and got the electrical towers upright and transmitting electricity during the surge. So Afghanistan is much, much more dependent on the gamut of assistance that is provided by all of these different international delegations and organizations. And if they withdraw, Afghanistan will be much the poorer for it. Finally, of course, you're going to see the reemergence of the warlord militias and a variety of other forces that will all be competing to take control of various parts of the country and of the capital city. So I fear that at this point in time, if the U.S. was to withdraw, this would by no means end that endless war. It undoubtedly would lead to something worse than the situation is right now. With that in mind, if I could very briefly put all of this in context, because I think that there are five lessons that we should have learned from the last 20 years of war against Islamist extremists. The first of those is that ungoverned spaces in the Middle East will be exploited by Islamist extremists. In fact, it's not just the Middle East or even the greater Middle East. It's really the Muslim world. Unfortunately, a very tiny percentage of a very large religion is inspired by twisted beliefs of the extremists and will take advantage of situations where they can establish sanctuaries, safe havens, and supporters. The second lesson is that we have to do something about it. You cannot study this problem until it goes away. It doesn't go away. It typically gets worse. And what happens there doesn't stay there. It tends to spew violence, extremism, instability, and a tsunami of refugees, not just into neighboring countries, but in many respects, all the way into Europe and our NATO allies and partners. And we saw that, of course, with the geopolitical Chernobyl of Syria, the meltdown of a country that sent millions of refugees into neighboring countries and indeed into Western Europe, causing the biggest domestic political challenges they have had since the end of the Cold War. The third lesson is that the U.S. typically has to lead. Not always. Sometimes you have a situation like Mali in France where another country is leading. But even there, the U.S. has to be involved because the predominance of the capabilities that are really important in the way we're now able to fight in these endeavors, which is by enabling host nation forces. So the capabilities, again, of drones, of precision air attack, of fusion of intelligence, a variety of other enablers, as they are termed, they support the forces of the host nation in combating extremists and indeed insurgents who can produce these ungoverned spaces in which extremists will seek sanctuary, noting that, of course, it was under Taliban rule that Al-Qaeda established the sanctuary in eastern Afghanistan where the 9/11 attacks were planned and the initial training of the attackers was conducted. Now, a caveat to lesson three about the U.S. having to lead, we should always seek to have a coalition of the willing, and it should include Muslim countries for which this is an even greater challenge. It can be an existential challenge in some cases in a way that is not true for the U.S. and our Western allies. The fourth lesson is to recognize that you cannot counter terrorists, extremists like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, with just counter-terrorist force operations. You cannot just drone strike or Delta Force raid your way out of this problem. You have to have a comprehensive civil military campaign, but we don't want to be carrying out many of the elements of that campaign. We want the host nation forces to do the fighting on the front lines, to do the political reconciliation, the reestablishment of basic services, the repair of damaged infrastructure, and on, all the tasks that Ambassador Crocker and I had to carry out in many respects during the surge in Iraq that our forces had to take responsibility for doing. But in this case, to have the host nations do that, and we have been able to do that, indeed, in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, in a variety of other countries. And that's the way we should proceed, needless to say. The fifth lesson is to recognize that this is not a fight of a decade, much less a few years. Rather, this is a generational struggle, if not longer. And what we need to do is make a sustained commitment that is sustainable in terms of expenditure of blood and treasure. Now, I would contend that having 3,500 or so U.S. forces in Afghanistan is very sustainable. It's very notable, for example, that we have not had a battlefield loss in Afghanistan, U.S. loss, in over a year. There have been accidents and other losses, but not battlefield activity. And clearly the cost of maintaining that number and supporting the Afghan security forces and important institutions is very sustainable. So if you keep those lessons in mind, I think you would conclude that what we should do in Afghanistan, recognizing that there is a continued threat of Al-Qaeda trying to reestablish a sanctuary there and now the Islamic State trying to do the same, that we should have a sustained, sustainable commitment to that country and enable the Afghan security forces and key institutions in their struggle with the insurgents who are eroding the security and have done so in recent years in particular, and in so doing are allowing opportunities for true international terrorists, Islamist extremists, to establish the kinds of sanctuaries that we went to Afghanistan to eliminate in the first place.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining us via Microsoft Teams is our special guest, retired U.S. Army General David Petraeus. He's currently a partner at KKR, a leading global investment firm where he chairs the firm's Global Institute. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to Medea Yorub Al-Hassan. He's editor-in-chief of Echo Al-Hayat News Agency in Baghdad, Iraq. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And let me turn back to my colleague, Jeff Selden, for some follow-ups.
General, you talked about the need for a sustainable commitment to Afghanistan. President Biden, in his news conference just last month, said he couldn't picture U.S. troops being in Afghanistan in 2022, a year from now. Is that giving the U.S. enough time to figure out some of these issues, or will simply pulling out all troops enable enough of a destabilization in Afghanistan that the progress that the U.S. had made might be lost?
First of all, I should note that, of course, some of that progress has clearly eroded in recent years. To its credit, the Obama administration in its final year halted the drawdown that was planned at that point in time. And indeed, in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, there was a modest buildup, again, quite modest, well under 10,000 troops still, and a number of those enablers that I described as being so important to helping our Afghan partners on the ground. But in the last couple of years especially, there has been an erosion as our forces have been drawn down. Again, in my view, without the conditions that would warrant that being present. I understand absolutely, again, the desire of both political leaders and their constituents, our citizens, to withdraw all of our forces. But, you know, we've had tens of thousands of troops committed to countries around the world, certainly not the kind of fighting that we see in Afghanistan, but we've had 30,000 to 40,000 troops on the ground in South Korea since the end, if you will, of that war, since the lines that were established, the armistice, noting that, of course, there is no true peace treaty there yet. We still have 30,000 troops on Japanese soil. We have tens of thousands of troops on European soil, and certainly maintaining 5,000 or so or a few less Americans with a coalition contribution of, say, 8,000 to 10,000 should be very doable. And I worry that if there is a withdrawal of our forces without the conditions being established that would warrant that withdrawal and without really quite significant agreements on what happens if the Taliban fail to live up to the terms of whatever agreement is reached, that that could be a situation that could prove quite catastrophic. Because, again, you could see the renewed civil war, such as we saw beginning 2 years after the Soviet forces withdrew from Afghanistan, finally, and established a government behind them, and when they cut the funding off for that some 2 years later, the country collapsed into civil war, and it was a very, very bloody period with huge refugee flows into neighboring countries and beyond. So at the end of the day, you have to be realistic, and the prospects for Afghanistan without U.S. forces and without an agreement that is really much more solid, if you will, has provisions for verification, perhaps even some international forces to observe it or some fashion that would make it a much more durable agreement than what appears to exist at this time. I fear, again, that the situation in Afghanistan would deteriorate quite rapidly.
General Petraeus, I want to turn your attention briefly to Iraq, another country in which you have enormous experience. How do you see Iraq post the U.S. intervention there? There has been many challenges politically, obviously, with the Shia population and others pressing for greater accountability, less corruption. How would you assess Iraq today and its ability to balance its affinity with Iran because of the Shia religious affinity while maintaining strong ties with the United States?
Well, I see considerable hope for Iraq and also considerable challenges. Noting, first of all, that the Iraqis will be the first to acknowledge that they have to have a relationship with their much larger neighbor to the east, even as they are very conscious that they are of different ethnic backgrounds, if you will, Arabs versus Persians, and of course, they speak different languages. Yes, the majorities of each country practice Shia Islam, but even that is a different form. Iraq has those considerable blessings, the land of the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, the only Arab oil-rich country that has fresh water. It is one of the top five oil reserve countries in the world, and it has tremendous farmland and many other blessings, including a still quite educated population and still decent infrastructure. It has a very fine prime minister, I believe. We knew him previously as a journalist, an activist, if you will, then the chief of the intelligence there, and has managed to navigate between the Shia-supported militias and political parties and those of other ethnic and sectarian groupings, between Arabs and Kurds, Shia and Sunni, the different tribes and all the rest of this that make Iraq so challenging. I believe his vision and that of his Minister of Finance and a number of other members of his government is very, very sound and very necessary. It acknowledges the bureaucratic deficiencies that it has, the corruption, the bloated political nepotism that is a feature of the government as well. And they have approaches that will address these various issues, although these are very difficult to get through the parliament, the Council of Representatives. It is a huge challenge that Iran would like to Lebanonize Iraq and also Syria for that matter. And by this, I mean that it would like to establish real muscle on the street the way they have with Lebanese Hezbollah, and that they would like to have the same kind of influence in the parliament that they have with their blocking veto in Beirut. And they're trying to achieve this, while others are certainly trying to prevent that from happening. Beyond that, of course, although the Islamic State Caliphate and the Islamic State as an army that really established that caliphate and maintained it are gone, defeated by Iraqi security forces supported by U.S. and coalition forces in the same manner that I was describing the approach for Afghanistan and is appropriate in a number of other places where there are serious Islamist extremist challenges. Nonetheless, the Islamic State is still present, but now in the form of insurgent groups and terrorist cells. And that requires, again, this kind of sustained, sustainable commitment. And here it might be the form of 2,500 or 3,000 troops in Iraq, maybe another 1,000 or 2,000 in Syria, with an ability to flow back and forth across the border as is necessary, and with some counterterrorist forces there to be sure. But most of our forces, again, providing training and equipping, advising and assisting, and above all, the enabling. And I think that that is an appropriate mission for our forces, and it is a mission that the Iraqi government, by and large, welcomes, noting that there are certain elements in the government, certainly those that are supported by and directed by Iran in many cases, are trying to force us out of the country because, of course, our presence does at times shore up the Iraqi government's efforts to resist those militias and those political pressures. So Iraq is in a somewhat fragile state, but it is nonetheless hopeful. And my hope would be that the great president, Dr. Barham Saleh, whom I've known since I was a two-star general in Mosul in 2003, and Prime Minister Khatami can forge a way forward that finally realizes the aspirations and the desires of the Iraqi people, who are keenly aware that it is just not acceptable that a country with the top five oil reserves in the world cannot provide 24-hour power for its citizens, and the country that has the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, cannot provide adequate drinking water for all of its citizens either.
General Petraeus, I'm going to ask you a big question, but I want a brief answer because I want to turn back to my colleague. On Iran, are you in favor of the Biden administration's desire to get back into the Iran deal from which the Trump administration withdrew? And to what extent do you think the United States can exert more pressure with our allies, European allies, with regard to Iran's malign activities in the region, especially via its proxies, whether in Yemen or Syria or Lebanon?
Again, there has to be a slightly nuanced answer to this. Certainly, we all want to see a diplomatic arrangement that rolls back the advances that Iran has made in its nuclear program, which put it closer to the possibility of enriching weapons-grade uranium. Noting that the agreement that was negotiated some 6 years ago or so did have sunset clauses that are more worrisome now than they were then. Now they are a good bit closer, and that is an issue that does have to be resolved. But again, having them roll that back and avoiding the necessity at some point of having to use military force to prevent Iran from enriching to weapons grade or establishing a nuclear device, I think that is obviously preferable. As to the other issues, the increasingly threatening missile program and the malign activities of its militias that are supported by the Quds Force in Iraq and Syria, in Yemen and some other locations as well, these are very nefarious and very worrisome. And of course, Lebanese Hezbollah being really the model for all of those militias. And yes, we can and should and are putting pressure on them together with partners and allies in the region and beyond.
General, two questions about terrorism. First, with the Islamic State, the early thinking seemed to be that if you could destroy the caliphate, the terror group would fall apart. Are you surprised at all at the tenacity with which its followers have hung on in Iraq and Syria, or at the way that the group has managed to spread its banners to the point where it seems to have picked up affiliates and followers in Africa, in Asia, despite the fact that its caliphate fell?
Not only am I not surprised, I actually predicted that we would have to contend with not only the Islamic State as insurgents and terrorist groups once its army was defeated. One of its huge mistakes, of course, was actually fighting as an army. But of course, it took an army to establish the caliphate. But that meant that then, you know, you're not going to fight any force that is enabled by the United States on the ground and succeed. As insurgents, however, and as terrorist elements, they can obviously endure a good bit longer. And as I predicted again years ago, when the fighting was going well, I said we should be ready to transition to a situation in which you won't be going after an army, you'll be going after insurgent groups and terrorist groups. And even if you put a stake through the heart of Baghdadi, which we subsequently did, you would not end the threat of ISIS on the ground, nor would we end the so-called virtual caliphate, the caliphate which is propagated through the use of various social media platforms and so forth, even as they are gradually going after ISIS activities in cyberspace. So this is a pernicious, durable, and enduring challenge with which we have to contend, and once again gives the reason for the sustainable commitment that I have proposed, rather than for the idea that you're going to take a hill, plant a flag, and go home to a victory parade. It's not that kind of fighting.
What about the concerns that have emerged more recently in the United States about domestic terrorism? And when officials talk about it globally, they often are talking about white supremacist extremism. How big is that threat? And could it get to the point, we've heard stories about white supremacist extremists traveling to Ukraine to fight either with Russia or with Ukraine as part of that war to get training. How big a problem could this become? Do you see it becoming a problem on the scale of an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda?
No. First of all, it is a very serious problem for the United States. You only have to look to the events of 6 January to recall why that is. And that, of course, followed the FBI director very forthrightly pointing out in public testimony on Capitol Hill that that form of domestic terrorism was becoming the most significant threat to the United States and more significant than that of Islamist extremism. Noting that actually even the cases of Islamist extremism that we have seen in the U.S. have generally been the result of self-recruiting rather than actions from outside our borders, such as the 9/11 attacks were. So clearly, this is a significant challenge for our country. It has been animated by a variety of the factors present in our political context. But the idea that this is going to have a huge outflow to other countries, I think, would probably be misplaced. But this is a very significant threat. And again, the challenge that is posed by those who have significant weapons and high-capacity magazines and all these other articles, really, of war, the kinds of weapons that we issue to our soldiers, this becomes quite a significant threat. And that is why the FBI has given it increased emphasis and why it is working very, very hard to gather information and intelligence on it, even as they are very aggressively following up the effort to prosecute those who were part of the attack on our capital on 6 January.
Do you worry about foreign adversaries trying to manipulate or use these extremists to meet their own goals as they compete with the United States, whether it's a Russia, an Iran, or some other player?
Sure. We have seen Russia in particular very skillfully pour gas on burning embers of various debates in our citizenry and try to inflame those so that indeed they undermine the very pillars of our democracy. And they will seize on racial disharmony. They'll seize on a variety of challenges that are being debated in our political system. and try to intensify those to the point that it brings discord and beyond hyperpartisanship.
General David Petraeus is a retired U.S. Army general, former director of the CIA. General David Petraeus, thank you so much for sharing your valuable insights with us. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you, Jeff.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. Joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.